Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to church today. This morning at the senior service, I mentioned Beatlemania. I wanted to make the point that people do ridiculous things for the things that they love. I was surprised at how many old ladies put their heads down in shame when I said Beatlemania. And some men as well. 1964, June, is that right, Tony? The Fab Four came down under. You're not embarrassed though, are you, Tony? No. Well, people do ridiculous things for love. I found a very peculiar romance story about Burton and Linda Pagash. To everyone in the world, they look like an ordinary, old, happy couple, but their story was really quite weird. 50 years ago, Bert proposed to Linda, and Linda rejected him. She became engaged to another man. So Bert hired a thug to throw lye in her face, and it blinded her. So the jury convicted Bert and sent him to jail for 14 years. And when he got out, he proposed to Linda again. And she accepted. Now, really, some people just do the strangest things for love. Across the scope of our society, you see it every year at Valentine's Day. I found some statistics. 3% of all pet owners will give a gift to their pet on Valentine's Day. 15% of all women will send flowers to themselves on Valentine's Day. And 53% of women will dump their boyfriends if they do not get a gift on Valentine's Day. Strange things for love. We're going to see a story today in the Bible which is about love. And it is about Jesus and a woman, and a woman who displays the most unbecoming, obsessed, Valentine-like obsession you'll ever see. And the people who are watching this scenario are disgusted. The conduct of Jesus in this saga discredits him. And when we first look at it, we think this is a crazy romance. But what looks that way to start with is in fact not about romance at all. This is about the type of love which goes much deeper, which is more pure, which is life-changing, and really, in the end, discredits the readers who are suspicious. Our story is in Luke chapter 7, starting at verse 36. It's about two people, really, who are reacting to Jesus in different ways. Someone who is highly enthusiastic, someone who is very indifferent. And this sort of fits in the ongoing story of Jesus that Luke has been telling in his biography, where from chapter 4, we see Jesus, the grown man, come along the scene, and week by week, chapter by chapter, we see more information about Jesus disclosed. We've seen more about his authority, about his nature, about his power, about his purposes and his motives, about his upcoming destination, about his character, about his love, and his good intentions. A lot of these things have been said about Jesus. Today, the spotlight of the biography switches from Jesus to we who are reading about Jesus, to us, the audience. It's getting personal and it's starting to demand a reaction from us. So we're going to see the reactions of these two people here in this story, and then afterwards we're going to expand out as Jesus tells a couple more stories to make us see how we are to respond to Jesus. So the first part of the story starts in chapter 7, verse 36. Now you can follow along in a pew Bible if you've got one in front of you. Page 1022, and it starts like this. The scene is at a party. Now one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. When a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume, and as she stood behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. And then she wiped them with her hair and kissed them and poured perfume on them. Now, I don't think there is any doubt when we just read these opening lines that this woman is obsessed with Jesus. She is obsessed with him. She's broken into a private function of a notable, upright Pharisee. And we learn that as she goes there, she's known to the people in the town. She has a bad reputation. She is regarded as a scandalous woman. I don't know why. I don't know what it is that she's done that's given her this reputation. Maybe she was a prostitute. Maybe she was an adulteress. I don't know how she knows Jesus either. I don't know when she first encountered him, how she first heard about him. What we know in this story is that her presence there at this party is embarrassing. It's embarrassing to the hosts and to the guests, and they label her a sinner. A sinner. Now, that word doesn't have a lot of bite with us these days. We live in a modern Western society where non-judgmentalism is a virtue, and so we don't go around calling people sinners, except in the rare cases like Josef Fritzl, that George mentioned before, when there is someone who is particularly scandalous, particularly evil. We don't hold back our punches then. Well, you get the impression from what they're cursing and muttering under their voices about this woman that they're calling her a Josef Fritzl, a sinner. We observe a little bit more about this woman as it goes on. We have a look at her behaviour. In addition to defying the public ridicule of the hosts and the people there, she displays an intense desperation to reach Jesus. And if you don't understand how a meal would have worked in the first century culture, so what would have happened is there would have been these low-lying tables, and the guests would be on cushions reclining on their sides, up on one elbow using the other arm to eat. And their legs would be moving away from the tables out into the darkness of the rooms. And then this is where the woman comes. She stands behind Jesus and she is utterly overcome with emotion. She stands there and she weeps bitterly. Her tears saturate his feet, we're told. And we don't see that type of crying very often in our world, so we can just assume that she is deeply emotional. She is overcome. But what we also realise is that she's not weeping because of shame. And she's not weeping because of grief or remorse or sorrow. But she's weeping because of relief, of gratitude, of high emotion. We don't see that type of emotion a lot either in our world. I was trying to think of an example and I thought, oh, okay, what about those times when a kid gets kidnapped and then they get rescued and then the parents get reunited? That's always really happy times. I found a story. This one happened in England last year, and it was about a girl named Shannon Matthews. You probably will remember this when I remind you, because she was a schoolgirl who went missing for 24 days, and they eventually found her locked up in a drawer in the bedroom of an uncle of the stepfather. And it took them that long to find her. Now, when they found her and they released her, of course, news spread to various people in the family. And just gauging the reactions, I read this story and I thought, awesome, this is the type of reaction we're looking for. So they asked Leon, her real natural father, they said, how did you feel when your daughter was found? And he said, oh, it was like winning the lottery. And his brother, the uncle, said, look, we've been saving a bottle. We just found it unbelievable. We saved it for this day. And their sort of final words were, oh, she's coming home and this is going to be one hell of a party. So, you know, you can imagine that excitement. They asked the mother, how did she feel? And the words were, she was in shock. And at first I thought, well, of course she would have been. How stunning. But then what happened was a week later they arrested the mother, who had been responsible for the kidnapping of the daughter and leaving it at the uncle, the stepdad, and it turned out to be a pretty horrible story all around. But at least for the natural fathers, he was real and genuine with his reaction. And we'll just go over to that side now and say, yeah, happy stuff, because that's exactly how the lady's feeling at Jesus' feet. She's absolutely overcome with relief and gratitude, and it completely puts her out of her mind. And we see that, and her tears fall on Jesus' feet. But we also see that she's embarrassed about the tears on his feet. We also find out later that his feet are filthy. They haven't actually been cleaned. But she, with no thought at all, bends down and with her hair cleans his feet as if she's embarrassed about even leaving a slight unworthy stain on his feet. And lastly, we see her take out this extremely expensive bottle of perfume in an alabaster jar, which, according to historians, means expensive stuff. And she pours it over his feet. So she is absolutely, utterly obsessed and devoted to Jesus. And we want to know why. And we want to know why he's accepting it. And in fact, that's what the guests and the host are thinking. And we'll come back shortly and see why. But now let's switch over to our other reaction, and that is of Simon the Pharisee. You see this in verse 39. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him, what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Clearly, our host is not impressed with Jesus. On one hand, we know that he acknowledges that Jesus is important, that Jesus is popular, and that there are many rumours going around that Jesus is possibly even a prophet from of old. Yet, in this moment now, Simon the Pharisee makes up his mind. He is revolted with this situation and he's deeply suspicious of Jesus. Why does Jesus not stop this woman? Jesus doesn't stand up, he doesn't move away, he doesn't glance over to his host with one of those looks saying, you know, help. He doesn't kick her or shoo her or do anything like that. She is a scandalous, sinful, unclean woman. If he was a prophet, if he was a teacher, if he was a holy man, he would never taint himself with association. And so Simon concludes that Jesus has to be false. He has to be a fraud. And he's revolted. And the essence of it is because he's revolted by the woman. Because she is unlike him. He can't stand to have that type of person around him. I wonder what revolts you, what really revolts you. And we'll gauge Simon's feelings by, you know, a comparison here. Some people are revolted by teenagers on the train, bulldog supporters, people of other nationalities, Japanese. Some people are revolted by pests. It's like spiders. You know, some people in the world are afraid of spiders. Go in their bedroom, open the drawer, there it is. Ah, oh, it's big and black and hairy. I'm not sharing a room with that. It's only the size of their fingernail, but still. They go sleep in the guest room that night. You know, things that revolt you. Cockroaches. I don't know. Well, to Simon, sinful people revolted him. And it revolts him that Jesus allows this. And subsequently, he rejects Jesus. Rejects him. So there are our two reactions. They couldn't be further apart, could they? Obsessed over here and Mr. Indignant over here. And in the face of this tension, Jesus tells a story. He says in verse 40, "Simon, I've got something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he says. "Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii, the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he cancelled the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" Simon replies, "Well, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt cancelled." And Jesus says, "You have judged correctly." Now, that story Jesus tells is a no-brainer. We know what he's saying. We get it. I mean, if National Australia Bank cancelled our phone bill or cancelled our mortgage, we know who's going to be the happier person. Simon gets it, but does he see him in this story? Well, if he doesn't, Jesus makes it pretty explicit. "Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, 'Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who has been forgiven little loves little.'" And herein lies the reason for the different responses. The woman who Jesus has conceded is a sinner, she has had her many sins cancelled by Jesus. And she is just over the moon with gratitude. She would not know how Jesus cancels her sins. She wouldn't understand that later Jesus would walk a path lonely and tortured to the hill of Calvary to be crucified, where he would bleed and die for her sins. She wouldn't know that. She wouldn't understand all the ins and outs of the intricate doctrines of the atonement and stuff like that. She just knows that she has this inner need. She's desperately shameful of her life. She knows that were she to stand before the Creator today, she would be unworthy. She would be offensive to him. She is desperate for forgiveness. She is desperate for acceptance. And she knows that Jesus has the solution. And she knows somehow that if Jesus loves her, if Jesus accepts her, then she'll be right with God. And so she hedges all her bets with him. She trusts him. And in his love, she finds forgiveness and she returns the love. But the Pharisee is different. He does not love because he does not feel he needs forgiveness. Now, I don't know what sort of person you are. You come today and you feel burdened, maybe, in your heart, conscious of a bad conscience, mindful of things that you've done in the past, feel dirty, feel ashamed. They might be things that were done a long time ago. And were you to be honest with yourself and were to square your shoulders with God, he would be angry, he would be judged, and so you fear that. If that's what's weighing in your heart, there is something really, really good about this story for you. That the worst of worst sins can't overcome the love of Jesus. He's determined to forgive people who trust him. He's capable of forgiving those who trust him. When he bled on the cross and died, it was a perfect man who died. But when he rose from the dead, it was the perfect Son of God who rose. He's made a perfect sacrifice for your worst secrets. And he has the power to forgive because he is the judge. Now, the woman came to Jesus desperate. But when she left, she was in peace. Jesus promised her that her sins were forgiven and that her faith in him had healed her. And you can leave the same way today. You need not be burdened by a conscience if you leave it all before the foot of Jesus. He will forgive you and he will love you and he will overwhelm you with the gratitude that is in this woman if you let him. Simon the Pharisee, he's not interested in that because he is very proud of his own achievements. He is a religious man. He is holy and he is righteous and he is upright and he keeps the law and he doesn't fear judgment day. He has great confidence in himself. He has no need for Jesus. He has no need for what Jesus offers. He doesn't need forgiveness. In fact, when we look closely at this story, we see not only does he not need Jesus, he doesn't want Jesus. He seems to go out of his way to insult Jesus. Do you know that for a host to treat the guests of honour like the way he treated Jesus would be appalling? It would be unheard of for a guest to not have their feet washed by a servant. But Jesus is really left there, ostracised at this party. What an insult. He doesn't love Jesus. And Jesus says he doesn't love him because he doesn't recognise the need for forgiveness. Simon has made a very, very big mistake. Jesus would be clear elsewhere, as it is clear in the Bible, that there is no person, not one, who is righteous. Romans 3:23. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. It doesn't matter how religious a person is. It doesn't matter how charitable a person is. It doesn't matter how good you think you are in society, how good your reputation is. It's not good enough for God. You need to hear that if you have tickets on yourself. When Jesus turned to the woman, he said, "Your faith has saved you." Because Jesus saved her. He needs to save you too. Now this leads, I guess, to the final part of our story today, which is the ongoing reaction to Jesus. This is how Luke turns this story into about us. For at the end of this story, we see the woman go off in peace, and we see the reactions of the Pharisees. It says here in verse 49, the other guests began to say amongst themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And there is an implication there. They just don't believe that Jesus can offer this. They don't accept that Jesus can give this. They reject Jesus. We see this continuing hardening of the Pharisees' hearts. The enemies of Jesus are getting more and more agitated. Yet at the same time, as soon as we go into the next chapter, the first three verses of chapter 8, we see another picture of reactions. At first, we see the inner following of Jesus, not only his 12 disciples, who he appointed a few weeks ago, but also now this entourage of supporters. And we're given a list of some women. And it's important that these women are listed. Jesus loved women, and Jesus was dependent on them materially. Some of these women were wealthy, some of them weren't, but they gave whatever they could to support Jesus. And yet in the backdrop of these supporters that are following Jesus around, we then see that there's this wider group called the crowd. The crowd's just there. Everywhere Jesus goes, the crowd is there. The crowd is the undecided. And to the undecided, Jesus tells another story. It's a famous story. We often call it the parable of the sower, the story about the farmer who throws out his seed, and it lands in different places and only grows really well in one location. Now, if you haven't heard that story, that's okay, because I'm just going to cut to the chase now and read the punchline. It starts in verse 11 of chapter 8. Jesus explains it. He says, "The meaning of the parable is this. The seed is the word of God, and those along the path are the ones who hear, but the devil comes along and takes away the word from their hearts, so that they may not believe and be saved. Those who are on the rocky ground are the ones who receive the word with joy when they first hear it, but because they have no root, they believe for a while, but in the time of testing, they fall away. The seed that fell among thorns stands for those who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by life's worries and riches and pleasures, and they never mature. And lastly, the seed on the good soil stands for those with a noble and good heart, who hear the word, who retain it, and by persevering produce a crop." Now, people today react to Jesus in all different sorts of ways. Jesus says there's only one reaction that counts. That is the reaction of the person who listens to his promises, who embraces his forgiveness, who trusts in his teaching, and who follows him all their life. Who let him rule them, let him love you. That's the person that counts. That is the woman at the party. The scandalous, sinful woman. She's good soil. Simon the Pharisee, he did not accept the word. And today, I reckon amongst us would be a fair reflection of different reactions to Jesus. Some of you simply don't believe you need forgiveness. You accept that Jesus is a good guy. You like how religious he makes you feel. You like the sentimentality of coming to church. You feel like you come here and you get some sort of injection of religiosity. You like Jesus' moral teaching. You like his inspirational stories, even his party tricks. But you don't think you need forgiveness. Why would you? You're a good enough person. You've tried your hardest. You don't hurt people. If that's you, can I just say, walk over there and sit with Simon the Pharisee, because that's how he's feeling. You might be at the other end of the spectrum. You might be bitterly aware of your shame and your need, that you are in desperate need of forgiveness, and you want it, and you see that it's in Jesus, and you fall on your feet, on his feet, and you cry bitterly, desperately asking him to wash you clean, and he does, and you're his forever and ever, like the woman. Great, go over there. But according to the parable of the sower, there's going to be a few different reactions in the middle. Some of you will hear, and simply it just is not going to bite. Some of you hear, but as soon as life goes tough, you give up on Jesus. And you know, there's a lot of people I encounter like this these days. Seems to me that whenever I flick onto the Australian Christian channel that's on TV, I hear a preacher telling me that God's meant to bless my life and I should trust in God to make me healthy and wealthy, and people put all their sort of hopes into this message, and then they find out that their life still sucks. And they think, well, Jesus has let me down. And so they reject him. They can't cope because things aren't rosy anymore. Well, some of us will be of that nature where we do like Jesus. We're grateful for the forgiveness. We want him to help us. But, you know, life is really complex. I'm so busy. I'm sure Jesus will understand. I haven't got time more than once or twice a month to pay him any attention. I've got a heavy career. I've got messy kids. I've got, you know, a mother who's sick. And it goes on. And, you know, got my hobbies. And I've got my interests. And, you know, I just don't have time. But Jesus will be good with that. You reckon? Or, you know, it's a little bit complex. There's so many things happen in my life. There's good things. There's struggles. It all gets too hard. You never get off first base. You never mature. You can't sort out things. Every day seems to be this ongoing struggle. That's not a good place to be. Jesus says the only reaction he wants is the reaction of the good soil. Now, I'm no good gardener, but I do know that to get good soil, you need to fertilize and you need to cultivate. And you need to weed. And that might be where you're at now. You need to make some changes in your life. You need to start cultivating your soil. And it starts by accepting that you need forgiveness. And it starts by realizing just how much forgiveness you need and being grateful for what Jesus offers and gives. And it moves into a desire to listen to him and let him talk to you and let him rule over you. And we get that from the Bible. We don't get that from our feelings. We don't get that from, you know, religion. We get it from his explicit word. He's spoken. It's there. Let him speak to you. Let him rule over you. And then lastly, it comes with dogged perseverance and resolve. Jesus doesn't promise to give us a healthy and wealthy life. He promises to give us his companionship and his strength. And he promises to work everything for our good, but he doesn't promise to make life rosy. And so when things are tough, and when their life is messy, and when you've got to struggle and work out your priorities, and when you've got to learn to say no to some things, and you've got to learn to face up to some duties that you've been given, and when you've got to do those sorts of things, when you've got to learn that you need to love people. I mean, I know some people love Jesus, but they don't love his people. They can't stand coming to church because they can't stand the people here. But if you don't love his people, seriously, you don't love him. Now, if this is where you're at, you've got to start persevering through those things. In fact, it's those very challenges that if you persevere through will help cultivate your soil. Now, in the end, this story of the party just says it all for us, where we need to start being with our reaction to Jesus. We need to love him. And we need to love him because we recognize how much he's done for us and how much we need him and how much he loves us, like the woman. And if you're not there yet, if you don't associate yourself with her absolute humiliating, unconscious behaviour, if you can't see yourself obsessing over Jesus, weeping bitterly, sparing no expense to honour him, giving your all, facing the humiliation and ridicule of the world, if you can't do that for Jesus, you have to ask yourself, how much has he forgiven of you? How much? Jesus said, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who has been forgiven little, loves little. Let's sing.